Managing Director Georgieva, I want to start with you. How much has the world economy changed over the past 6 to 12 months?
Vis-a-vis 12 months ago, it has gotten worse. But vis-a-vis 6 months ago, it has gotten better. What we witness is the world economy has been remarkably resilient. And when you look at the...
One underlying challenge, I would say, is that a lot of Asia's growth rested on a US-China trade corridor. And as that corridor thins, as it thins out, we've already got to find a substitute for it. This is where I come to the opportunity. If the US is going to reconfigure trade, we've got to reconfigure trade as well. You know, this is a blessing of the US tariffs. It's spurring regional integration and it's spurring bridges between regions.
So we're really still in the early stages of defining a new trade regime. Mm-hmm. And it's been extraordinary in so many dimensions. One is that the 9 most important policymakers when it comes to global trade policy are the Supreme Court justices of the United States. Sometime probably after hearing arguments about...
The IMF World Bank annual meetings hosts a number of panels about the global economy, and this one on trade featured an impressive lineup, including IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva, the President of Singapore, the CEO of the Nasdaq Exchange, EU Central Bank President Christine Lagarde, and last but not least, my guest on the podcast today, Gordon Hansen, the Peter Wertheim Professor in Urban Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School.
Where I'm also currently serving as Academic Dean for Strategy and Engagement. I'm an international economist and study the impacts of globalization on labor markets.
Great. Thank you so much and welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you, Bruce.
So you've just wrapped up a panel discussion about global trade here at the IMF during the annual meetings, where one of the panelists was President Tharman of Singapore, who suggested it was time to, you know, in response to U.S. actions in the past several months, that it was time to reconfigure global trade with partners, you know, EU, Asia, Canada, Australia. Is it possible to think of global trade without the U.S., do you think?
I think it is a possibility in the near term, and the near term means however long it takes us to get through this moment of political change and political transition. You know, we prior to the tumult that came from President Trump's first election and then the first round of U.S.-China trade war, and now we kind of have second round of that trade war. It wasn't like the global trading system was in great health. Mm-hmm. Once the conclusion of the Uruguay round and the creation of the World Trade Organization, we didn't do much. So you have to go back to mid-late 90s since anything significant has happened other than regional trade agreements. And so we need a reinvigoration of how we organize those agreements, and we need new actors to lead in terms of what those would look like. And countries like Singapore, newly high-income countries, middle-income countries playing a leading role in constructing that system, I think is inevitable. And the U.S. has given kind of the rest of the world a big push to get us closer to that reality.
Mm. And as part of your response to President Tharman's comments was kind of surprising in that you talked about how the U.S. Supreme Court justices might have a pretty significant or important role to play in determining the direction that the U.S. takes or, you know, could have significant impact on the direction of the global economy. So make that link for us.
It's pretty astounding, and it captures how unusual the current moment is. And where this comes from is the fact that the U.S. Constitution gives our Congress the power of the purse, and that means the authority to levy taxes. Import tariffs are taxes. Yet, on occasion, Congress gives the president authority to do things regarding the international economy and especially regarding international security. One of the things it did in the 1970s was pass something called the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, And this was right after the U.S. had abandoned the gold standard. Financial markets globally were in tumult. We were trying to figure out, you know, what was the world we were moving towards. And giving the president some authority to do some things as a part of that transition seemed sensible at the time.
Right.
So what the Trump administration has done is to use that act to levy tariffs on the entire world, saying we have two crises. One is fentanyl. That's just Canada and Mexico. But the other are trade deficits. Now, one, there's no kind of established belief in trade deficits being a crisis, but I think it's the Supreme Court is likely to let the president define what a crisis is. The question is, can you go as so far as to say, no, part of the power of the purse, a very big part, actually resides with the president? And this is going to be a yes or no thing. Now, they can be some interpretation and other stuff, but it's really, can Trump levy a worldwide 10% tariff with higher tariffs on some countries or not? And we're going to find out probably around January of 2026.
Wow. So tariffs are not a new thing. They've been around for a long time. There was a moment after World War II, and I've heard you tell this story, where the powers decided, in order to avoid another conflict, that they needed to start trading with each other and lowered tariffs to facilitate that. Do you expect we might see another moment like that, where the powers decide once again, given all the political tension out there, to drop these tariffs and start trading with each other to avoid another conflict?
Well, it depends on whether by powers you mean the U.S. is included or not. If the U.S. were not to be included, I think in the panel we just had, President Tharman of Singapore outlined an approach that would involve countries representing a substantial share of world trade coming together and saying, this is what's going to replace the WTO. This is a compact. It's not necessarily an agreement, but a framework for how we go about negotiating low and stable trade barriers with each other, the rules of the game, as it were. And then countries will figure out what to do within that framework. And I think if the Supreme Court decides that President Trump can do what he wants, then that's going to be a strong impetus for that Singapore Accord coming into being. If we imagine the U.S. as being part of that, it's much harder to see, absent an event that was as motivating as the devastated state of the global economy after World War II, two world wars, both the specter of future conflict involving the Soviet Union, and just the economic loss, the loss of life, the enormous damage to cities and to physical capital. And that provided a push in terms of saying, we need to do big things and we need to do them now. And if we're going to grow together as a global community of interlinked nations, trade, freer trade has to be part of that. And that was a very strong incentive, but it took two world wars and a Great Depression to get there.
Yeah, and it's taken 60 or 70 or more years to sort of forget about why it happened in the first place.
We do forget. And these eras, these epochs, they don't last that long. Hmm. If we think about the era of hyper-globalization as starting kind of after the dust had settled with the fall of the Berlin Wall and China really entering the global economy, so call it mid-90s, it was definitely over by 2015. Mm-hmm. And probably it was running on fumes in 2015. So you're talking about kind of like a 15-year period.
Yeah.
And that was it. And so what we're in now won't last forever either. I think many of us might hope that it's shorter rather than longer. But this state of uncertainty and this much tension in the system kind of breeds its own demise in a sense.
Mm. And speaking of epochs, you're a bit of an expert on the China shock, where, you know, China entered the global economy and what happened after that. And you speak now of sort of a China shock 2.0. What is that all about?
The idea that motivated the China 1.0 thinking was, here was a massive change in the structure of the global economy precipitated by events in a single country. And China's joining the global community of trading nations meant a huge increase in the supply of labor-intensive manufacturers and a huge increase in demand for the primary commodities needed to make those manufactured goods. Happened so fast, and China was so big, and China's specialization was so narrow that it was really disruptive. Mm-hmm. Sometimes for the benefit of some countries, for the harm of other countries, I think overall very clearly for the benefit of the global economy. What we're going through now is something entirely different. This is China deciding that it wants to become the leader of a set of high technology industries because it sees that, one, as its destiny, but it also sees it as essential for its geopolitical goals and in terms of maintaining economic stability at home. And so that means it's not doing things the market would do on its own. It is providing state-directed investments that are pushing China into electric vehicles and batteries and aerospace and semiconductors and AI, big pharma, and the list goes on. And it's doing that through aggressive subsidies, but with the market playing a role, because you both have companies competing with each other to get in line for government support, but also regions competing with each other to attract those companies and become new global industry centers. China's willing to put so much money into this that it is globally disruptive, especially for countries that are also producing those goods.
Hmm. Yeah. And so what do you think about this push to bring manufacturing back to the U.S.? I mean, is that an achievable goal, do you think? And who would be the real beneficiaries if the U.S. were to make that happen?
So when I hear politicians talk about bringing manufacturing back, what I really hear is we want to create more good jobs for workers without a college degree, because we haven't been able to do that for the last 45 years.
Which is true.
Which is true. And so I would heartily endorse that as being a problem that is worthy of national attention. And it's not just a U.S. problem. It's a problem in many high-income countries, and it's becoming a problem in some middle-income countries as well. China is facing a version of this, not so much in terms of non-college workers, but workers who graduated kind of at the lower end of the country's newly established educational institutions. So I would endorse us taking on that challenge. Really doubtful that manufacturing is going to be the vehicle through which we could accomplish that. In the U.S., manufacturing is about 8% of employment. And even if we were to increase the size of the sector by 50%, we're at 12%. We haven't come close to addressing the challenges of creating those good jobs for non-college workers. And so any feasible strategy is going to have services. That can be healthcare, it can be parts of IT, it can be the construction trades sector as at the center of that good jobs creation. The ability of tariffs to bring manufacturing back and create lots of good jobs for non-college workers, we already have evidence in on this. This is work I've done with David Autor, David Dorn, and Anna Beck, which shows that it hasn't happened. The Trump tariffs that were put in place after 2018 have not generated manufacturing growth in the regions that were targeted. So I get where the motivation comes from, and I think the motivation comes from a good place and an economically sensible place, but I think the policy tools we're using are not the correct ones.
So finally, how do you see this playing out for the U.S.? With all the industrial policy, the tariffs, et cetera, will it strengthen or weaken its position in the global economy?
Well, we have weakened our standing as a global economic leader. And the question is, how long will that last? Now, in saying that, I don't want to say that it's been an unequivocal diminution of our status and power, because what President Trump has done is to show that the U.S. has a fair amount of unilateral leverage, and we can get away with some stuff. Now, the question is, can we do that for very long before countries retaliate? I think the answer to that is probably no. And so we have created the specter of a powerful United States acting on its own, which is quite unsettling. But if we're an unreliable partner, I think that reduces our standing, especially in an environment where we face actors like Russia being willing to invade neighboring states, and the prospect of China massively investing in its own industries in a way that would distort many other economies. So despite the fact that the U.S. has upset lots of friends and allies, I think there's still a demand for the U.S. to play a leadership role. It's going to take us a while to get back there because we've shown that we're willing to put U.S. interests front and center, full stop, and that creates some wariness.
Gordon Hanson, professor in urban policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bruce. It's been great to chat with you.
Again, that was Gordon Hanson, the Peter Wertheim Professor in Urban Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. You can watch the webcast of the debate on the global economy seminar that happened during the IMF World Bank annual meetings at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.